Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. Big focus today on the 2025 budget. It places an even heavier burden on taxpayers, but are there any bright spots? We look at the increased budgets allocated to local municipalities. Does this mean we might see better service delivery? And the South African Revenue Service has a bigger slice of the budget pie. What is it going to do with the money? Also, concerns around the hold that tobacco has on young people in South Africa. It's Friday, the 14th of March. Now, it's widely accepted that after this week's budget, things are generally not in a good shape for taxpayers. We've seen the VAT hikes over this year and next year, stagnant tax brackets, and even plans to tax foreign pension income. I think it's fair to say the financial squeeze is getting a whole lot tighter. So at the end of the week, I want to try and pull all of this together, and we're joined by Thomas Loban, who is director at Ibex Consulting, a division of Latita Africa. Thomas, a very warm welcome. Let's dive straight into VAT if we can. Treasury says it's going to raise revenue, but the flip side to that is it's going to disproportionately hurt lower and middle income households. Was this the perfect solution?
Well, firstly, thanks, Jeremy. Good to be here. And secondly, I don't think anybody could disagree that a 0.5% VAT increase is a little bit better than a 2% VAT increase, as we now understand was initially proposed. It's a bitter pull, but something that's a bit easier to swallow given that we do see an expanded basket of zero-rated goods. I guess time will tell whether that'll have a positive impact on sentiment, but let's see by October for the medium-term budget policy statement.
I suppose on the good side, SARS is getting billions more for enforcement. So what does this mean in your opinion? Should we now be on standby for more aggressive tax collection efforts?
It's always a difficult balance to strike as a tax practitioner, speaking to your audience about SARS in this way. Personally, one feels that a more robust SARS is a net good for the country. Of course, taxpayers should only be worried if they're non-compliant, but we do see in many cases that even compliant taxpayers can be treated somewhat unfairly by an over-aggressive SARS. What the aim here is with further boosting SARS budget is really giving them the right tools to take aim at the right taxpayers, those who are non-compliant. And again, as has been SARS's approach, aiming from the top down, the largest, most non-compliant taxpayers, and then trickling down to the smaller instances of non-compliance that can snowball. So again, let's see, but I'm very hopeful. Usually SARS has done quite well with the tools it's been given. So if they're given more, they can do more.
Just test my thinking in this respect. The budget, the way I saw it, assumed compliance as far as tax is concerned. But what about tax avoidance? And I'm wondering whether any new measures implemented by SARS could push more people into the informal economy.
I think, firstly, we need to differentiate between tax avoidance and tax evasion. Tax avoidance is legal. You know, that's using legal means to avoid where you can tax liability or minimizing the extent of your liability. For the everyman, you might hear about loopholes being taken advantage of. But tax evasion is another issue altogether. That's where you're obfuscating or hiding your income from SARS. And that is a concern. We've seen that in other economies where they go informal or cash-based. I absolutely do think that that is a concern, and I'm not alone in the sentiment. There are many economists and people much smarter than myself who have raised the same concern, citing the so-called Laffer curve, where your rates are too high and you ironically collect less. again, this is something that we'll have to see in action over the next few months, but this tax practitioner does think that that is now going to become a big threat.
No tax bracket adjustments, if I'm correct, if I remember, this is for a third year in a row. But effectively, Thomas, how much more tax will people be paying?
This is something that, Jeremy, I hung my head low when I saw. In the leaked budget review that for the budget speech that would have been held in February, we saw that there was going to be an inflation-linked increase in the tax brackets. Now we're seeing no increase for the second consecutive year. What this means is that taxpayers are earning less after tax, adjusted for inflation. So if you count an inflation rate of between 5 and 6% a year, for example, you'll now be 10 to 12% poorer in real money terms. If you get an increase at work, even if it's inflation linked, that now could push you into a higher tax bracket, even though the real value of your money is the same.
Something else which I think was controversial was the move to tax foreign pension income. So who does this impact and why is there concern over this, Thomas?
Way back when the residency-based system of tax was introduced in South Africa, there was a decision made to avoid the taxation of foreign pensions. So let's start with who this affects. If you are an expatriate who worked outside of South Africa and contributed to a pension fund outside of South Africa, when you return to South Africa, the pension that you receive from that, whether it's a lump sum annuity or pension in true form, that would have been exempted in South Africa, presumably taxed in the other country, at least in most cases. It would also affect foreigners who are seeking to retire in South Africa, having worked abroad, contributed to a foreign pension, and now coming to live here and becoming residents. That is where we'll see the biggest impact. This is something that will hurt sentiment in South Africa, specifically those wanting to settle in South Africa or invest themselves in South Africa over the long term, because this is, again, another area where SARS is trying to extend its reach into foreign coffers and collect tax that previously it did not. Simply put, this is something that will hurt sentiment towards the economy, especially an economy that most taxpayers, new and current, don't feel gives back much to those paying taxpayers.
Just in conclusion, I want you to take your tax practitioner hat off and maybe put an economist's hat on, if you don't mind. Just a broad overview. What do you think this budget really signals about South Africa's short-term financial future?
Well, I appreciate it, Jeremy, and I'll do my best. Frankly, this comes across as South Africa having no more headroom. We're unable or unwilling to reduce government expenditure very much, and we will find other ways and means to tax the taxpayers more, keeping in mind that 90% of government revenue comes from these taxes. It's not something that would be a positive signal for economic growth, and certainly I would be shaken as an investor looking at South Africa as a potential market. We'll have to see by next year what changes are made, but right now, government is stuck.
I'm going to leave it there. Thomas Laban, thank you very much indeed, Director at Ibex Consulting.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As South Africa digests the 2025 budget, a critical debate is emerging. Does local government deserve a larger share of the national budget? Local municipalities, I don't need to tell you, are at the forefront of service delivery, yet they often face financial constraints that hinder their effectiveness. Recent discussions suggesting that an increase in the allocation for local government is being considered in the budget. Well, let's see what emerged a little earlier. Kevin Allen, Managing Director of Municipal IQ, is front and center of this debate. Kevin, a very warm welcome. So there's been an increase in the local government equitable share, rising from 99.5 billion to 115.7 in 2027-28. All of this to help municipalities cover bulk water and electricity costs for indigent households. How does that sit with you?
Yeah, it was pretty much expected from any local government stakeholder who had an eye on the pragmatism of this year's budget. Not a lot of money to go around, and the minister was definitely not going to spend much on local government. And the increase to local government, just to be clear, is to the equitable share from 99 to 115 in a year's time is about 5%. So that's around inflation, and that's really what local government gets every year. So really local government didn't get much beyond what was expected at all.
So it's not really going to make a huge difference, I think I'm hearing you say.
Well, given inflation, local government staying at about the same. But, you know, considering how tight things were in the budget, there were some real losers, you know, including some social grants and some people paying tax. I think local government will actually have got away okay. There were those who thought that local government deserved a huge increase, a very significant or quite dramatic increase, especially in its conditional grants. So local government gets equitable share grants and then conditional grants for infrastructure. But given that conditional grant spending is at about 75%, so local government is only, municipalities are only able to spend 75% of what they're already being allocated, then I'm not sure it would have, National Treasury would have seen it as prudent to give local government any more that, in terms of conditional grants. So those are staying pretty much the same as well.
Kevin, the minister also referencing phase two of Operation Vulindlela, which we know aims to reform local government. What practical changes would you like to see emerging from this at local or municipal level?
Well, Operation Vulindlela, the president also spoke about it in his State of the Nation address, things that he wanted to see local government getting a bit more of attention there. But really, those were pretty much broad strokes. So it was no surprise as well that given the broad strokes of what was being said about local government, you know, positive commentary on that by the president in his sona, that there wasn't much practical positive news then in the budget. And really, the president was talking about having a new white paper and a new funding model for local government. But really, that is around the policy side of things. I'm not sure. We'll have to see what comes of that. I'm not sure whether much substantial will come from that. What I'm hoping to see from those policy initiatives, though, is to see local government, things tightening up generally for municipalities, more accountability, more pressure on local government to spend money that it's getting, and generally to get local government to do a better job across the board in terms of performance, but also with the money it's already getting to maybe justify a case for more money down the line.
Talking about performance, and give me a steer on this one, several metros qualifying for performance-based grants. Are there lessons here that that struggling municipalities could learn from the more financially stable entities?
Yes, absolutely. So already there's incentivization in the grant structure where if you spend money, Treasury will be more inclined to give you more money. If you don't spend the money that you've been allocated, and I'm speaking specifically about conditional grants, which are around very desperately needed infrastructure in municipalities, but many municipalities don't spend their infrastructure conditional grants. What happens then is Treasury takes the money away, which is crazy given the state of our local municipal infrastructure. So I think incentivization is a good thing to make sure that our municipalities actually spend the money they're allocated. And I think at the metro level, you know, we're seeing a formalization of this rewarding system. And I think it's good. There's a small pot of money for local government. There's a lot to be done with it. And if you spend well, and if you spend on the right things, you will be rewarded for that in terms of access to better grants in the future. I think that's a good thing.
There's also, you talk about working better, which I absolutely accept, but there's also the argument, isn't there, that inefficiencies and mismanagement at municipal level remain the real issues and not necessarily funding. There is some accuracy in that perspective, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. That is absolutely right. We need to do more to get municipalities on the right track and to get municipalities working properly. And this has got very little to do with money. You can't give money to a municipality that is failing It's really just throwing good money after bad. So the real challenge for municipality, for local government, and indeed for residents who live in municipalities, which all of us do, is to actually get municipalities on the right track and get them working properly. And what's needed here is actually to make municipalities more accountable, to make them more responsible for what they do, to hold them to account and to hold them to book where things go wrong, to take action. And that is incumbent on, firstly, provincial government. Provincial government needs to do more to regulate municipalities within their provinces and to make sure that they step in when necessary. And then, of course, national government, which should be framing the debate. And beyond that, political parties as well have a key role to play to ensure that their councillors, political parties are, councillors are really representatives of political parties. But political parties need to do more to make sure that they're holding their councillors to account and making sure that they're doing a good job and removing them where they seem to be corrupt or incompetent.
And I'm going to thank you for that perspective. That's Kevin Allen, Managing Director, Municipal IQ. I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
More now on Budget 2025 and the South African Revenue Service. As you well know, it's been historically underfunded with an estimated 800 billion rand in unpaid taxes, a funding shortfall of over 5.5 billion and a newly allocated 7.5 million boost over the next 3 years. I think the big question is this enough? What does it mean for taxpayers? I want to give you a view on that with Robin Galloway, Senior Manager at Forbes Mazars South Africa. Robin, a very warm welcome. So we know that SARS was underfunded by over 30% last year. One's got to ask the question why it's taken so long for government to address the shortfall.
Absolutely, Jeremy. I think this additional allocation to SARS was definitely one of the few positives coming out of Wednesday's budget. So in addition to the 3.5 billion rand allocated to SARS last year to modernize its systems, the budget allocated an additional 4 billion rand to SARS, which should go a long way in assisting SARS to clamp down on tax evasion. And the return of investment here, Jeremy, could be significant. I mean, we understand that 260 billion rand of the total tax collected this past year was a result of increased SARS capacity. So we're really hoping for a significant change here.
Robin, you say it could go a long way, but let me test you on that. 7.5 billion does sound like a lot, but against a backdrop of 800 billion in uncollected taxes, you've got to ask the question if that is enough to close the gap. I guess it's all in the strategic deployment of that allocation.
Absolutely. I think our feeling is that SARS could have got a lot more. I know that Gondwana and Kiswete have been, I think they've had at least three conversations between last month and this past Wednesday. I think we agree with you, Jeremy. I think the more we give SARS here, I mean, they were given, I think, 1 billion rand to modernize their systems last year, and that's already borne substantial fruit if we look at what they've collected. And you're quite right. Even if Kiswete's estimate of 800 billion rand is half correct, I mean, an additional 400 billion rand would make this VAT increase, the necessity of any tax increase, it seem like a moot point. So I definitely think it's money well spent, but I think the SARS could definitely have done well with at least double that, Jeremy.
Just picking you up on one point, so the funding, as you correctly say, is going to modernize SARS. So does this mean, in your opinion, an increase in maybe AI-driven audits and even automated tax enforcement?
Absolutely. I think just looking at the budget and the wording coming out the budget, we think they may need more personnel, but it will definitely look at improving efficiencies around machine learning and using AI to really streamline the whole collection process. I mean, Jeremy, on your submitting your tax return, I'm sure you've noticed over the last 5 years a significant improvement with automated assessments, etc. So what we're hoping to see here, Jeremy, is a lot less manpower needed and a lot more machine learning and AI to drive up tax compliance. So I think that's what we're hoping to see here out of this additional.
All right, Rob. So let's assume then that SARS, for the short term at least, is now properly resourced. Should we then, as taxpayers, expect a more assertive or aggressive crackdown on overdue tax returns and unpaid debts? Surely that's going to happen.
Absolutely. Look, just listening to Kiswet earlier this week, he's apparently, Jeremy, identified 100,000 non-compliant taxpayers that have income of over R1 million a year that aren't even registered for tax. And the audits we see coming out of SARS at the moment are increasingly more sophisticated, they're more automated. And so I think we can accept what Kiswet is promising here in good faith. They've also identified 156,000 people that are above threshold that haven't even registered for tax or submitted returns. So we know these people are out there. My feeling is that SARS now knows who they are. They've apparently identified 30,000 people in this category. And so I think that they've got a limited amount of time to hide here, Jeremy. We can expect to see quite a bit of enforcement coming through the news over the next 6 to 12 months.
So, Robin, I'm flying a little bit of a kite here, but it's common cause that South Africa has one of the highest tax burdens in the world. So let's assume that SARS is going to become more efficient, say, in the short to medium term. Is it out of the ballpark to say that we could see tax relief in the future? Or am I just being a little naive?
No, you're quite right. I think relative to our peers, we're looking at the levels of personal income tax rates, corporate income tax rates. I mean, that's at 27%, top 13 out of 143 countries. So I think we've been trying to tax ourselves out of a fiscal debt problem for a long time, which is just unsustainable. What we were really hoping for here, Jeremy, is a bold budget where the government of national unity would take decisive steps to cut spending and to start slowing down, you know, the fiscal debt pile. We didn't see any of that coming through the budget, which was really a disappointment for us. But our hope is that hopefully Kiswet and his team will do his part over the next few years to use this additional funding wisely to take pressure off the taxpayers bearing the brunt of the shortfall going forward.
But as you rightly say, all very well for SARS to be fully funded or better funded, but if spending isn't cut, we're just going to come back to tax hikes at some point anyway, aren't we?
Absolutely. And they've only got three options here. If we look at where the source of revenue is coming from, I mean, we've got personal income tax, which brought in R811 billion. We've got VAT at R500 billion, and we've got corporate income tax. Now, as I alluded to earlier, personal income tax and corporate income tax is already saturated. I mean, we're seeing corporate income tax rates coming down globally, and we need to follow that trend. And so VAT, look, the minister was in a very tight position. Some people say it was self-imposed over the last sort of 10 years, but I think they've got limited choice now. They're having to look at ways to cut expenditure. Apparently, there's an expense review that's going to take place, but Jeremy, there have been 230 expense reviews undertaken by government since 2013, and we haven't seen any of them result in substantial cuts on items like catering, traveling. So I don't want to be cynical here, Jeremy, but the proof's going to be in the pudding.
Robin Galloway, thank you very much indeed. Senior Manager, Forwards Mazars South Africa. Appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday. Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
With a rapidly growing youth population and regulatory loopholes to exploit, Big Tobacco is said to be aggressively pushing new nicotine products. What am I talking about? E-cigarettes to heated tobacco and even snuff, marketing them as safer alternatives. But just how safe are they, and what does all of this mean for public health in South Africa and beyond? Professor Lekan Ayo-Yusuf is head of the School of Health Systems and Public Health at the University of Pretoria. He spent much time researching the industry's evolving tactics and their impact on public health, and joins me on the program now. Professor, a very warm welcome, and your research indicates and highlights just how the tobacco industry is aggressively expanding in Africa. What are your biggest concerns around their marketing tactics?
Thank you, Jeremy. The major concern I have is the fact that they are not necessarily in full disclosure of exactly the nature and the intent of the marketing approach, particularly to the harm reduction. Harm reduction is a concept that was taken from the illicit drug use, wherein you actually provide a supervised alternative that reduces the social and medical harm to those who are not able to quit immediately, but they're able to get a substitute. So that basically a high risk, what we call a high risk supervised. We do not market methadone to the whole population because we want to deal with illicit drug users. So this is what we're dealing with the current use of harm reduction as a population-wide approach. So all we are asking is that this needs to be regulated, and particularly young people who don't even smoke or use any nicotine needs to be protected by the regulation that's been proposed. In that way, if any group of smokers may benefit, they may still be able to have it without having it being banned. Importantly is that there's no evidence in South African context that have shown that using these alternatives actually kept smokers away for longer than 6 months. Our studies show that they often, or most of them, relapsed that used e-cigarette compared to those who didn't use e-cigarette to attempt to quit.
And Professor, just looking at what is happening, one senses a very sophisticated pivot as far as the industry is concerned. And all of this is being done strategically and very tactically.
Indeed, it's clear that the industry is not growing in the African continent as much as would have wanted to when it comes to cigarette smoking. So they needed to come up with alternatives, and that's the harm reduction. And we always say this is a reduction in harm to their profit rather than public health gains. So indeed, we need to be vigilant. I need to also explain the whole idea about safer is essentially based on having lower exposure to some of the toxins. And when we say lower exposure, does not necessarily translate to safe. For example, you can have 10, let's give an example of a quantity of 10 milligram that's enough to cause cancer. So even if you have 100, it would not matter. You will still get the cancer. So if you bring it down to 20, you will still get the cancer, even though it's reduced exposure. So this is one of the challenges that we have to explain to the public and explain to policymakers that the industry is actually abusing some of these concepts.
Professor, you talk about all of this needing to be better regulated, but I would ask you whether you think government has an appetite to do this, given that products like this are a source of excise revenue.
That's another myth about tobacco and nicotine as a source of revenue. It does, because the excise is paid by the user. It is taxed as production. The manufacturer pays upfront and carries the cost onto the smoker or the user. So all that money comes from the user. When the user stops using, that money still remains available in the economy to buy a phone or shoes or pay school fees. So it remains in the economy. So the government, for example, is collecting 12 billion in excise, but spends 42 billion rand in treating tobacco cost illnesses and the foregone earnings from those who die prematurely. The total of that in South Africa has been expended to be about 1% of the GDP. That's a lot of money, 42 billion every year, against the collection of 14 billion. So it is really a myth that government is actually gaining anything from continuing to allow the health harm that is caused by these products.
Professor, you also point out that South Africa has one of the highest rates of snuff use in the world. I wonder to myself why this product is still so popular and how it compares to traditional smoking in terms of risk to health.
So just to correct that, it's not the highest in the world, but you know, India has the highest rate of snuff use, but in African context, South Africa has one of the highest, next to Lesotho. It's pretty much a cultural use, but the tobacco industry has obviously, again, come onto this and lapped onto it. A couple of years ago, they introduced some of this modernized, as they were called in Sweden, the snus. So the snus was then marketed as a safe alternative, just the way we have e-cigarettes. So we've seen this happen before, back in 2005. The issue here is that they've got these carcinogens or cancer-causing substances that are not good for the mouth, oral cancer, where you place them. The new ones have lower carcinogens, but again, the WHO has recommended an amount of carcinogen, not because it's safer, but because they found that it's possible for manufacturers to lower these carcinogens. Why do they put so much more? And we found South African snus, equivalent of the one that they supply in Sweden, had even more carcinogens or cancer causing agents than the one they supply in Sweden. So the industry definitely needs to be regulated in our environment because they see it as a space to do whatever they can.
Professor, you also mentioned that vape shops are now strategically placed in many instances near universities. What does this tell us, in your opinion, about the industry's true motives?
It is clear we had expected, if it was the intention was to actually reduce harm and had benefit to public health, these vape shops will be located in spaces where smoking is quite prevalent, in the locations or in some particular places in Cape Town. We know that a lot of people smoke. But what we found is when we measured the distance within vape locations and those who responded, we had interviewed about 18,000 South Africans across the 9 provinces and did a geolocation of vape shops and where they were. The respondents were living, and we found the closer they stayed with to a vape shop, the more likely they were going to be vapers. And those vape shops were also very strategically close to higher education institutions where you find young people. So it was clear to us that the intent was not to get to smokers who would benefit the most, but to get to customers where they will profit the most.
I'm going to leave it there. A very disturbing picture that you paint, but one I think that we need to absorb and take notice of. Professor Lekan Ayo-Yusuf is the head of the School of Health Systems and Public Health at the University of Pretoria. Thank you very much indeed. And that's MoneyWeb at midday for today. We are back on Monday, live at noon, and then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.